Well, welcome everyone. This is our 16th lecture in the philosophy department's most prestigious lecture series, the Amherst Lecture in Philosophy. All our lectures are published online together with supplementary media at amherstlecture.org. It's an indexed and fully searchable website that is a permanent archive of all the wonderful talks that we've hosted over the past decade and a half. These talks and the development of the website would not be possible without the generous help of the Department of Philosophy at Amherst College and the Forey and Micken Fund in Philosophy and Science. This afternoon, our speaker is Professor Haslinger. Sally Haslinger is the Ford Professor of Philosophy in the Department of Linguistics and Philosophy at MIT and an affiliate in the MIT Women's and Gender Studies program. Her work links issues of social justice with contemporary work in epistemology, metaphysics, philosophy of language, and philosophy of mind. Professor Haslinger has published in metaphysics, epistemology, feminist theory, and critical race theory. In 2018, she was awarded a Guggenheim Fellowship for a book titled Doing Justice to the Social, which is forthcoming with Oxford University Press. Professor Haslinger has not only devoted herself to expanding philosophical discussion, but also to expanding access to philosophy. She is a founder and convener of the Women in Philosophy Task Force, which is an umbrella group that works to advance women in philosophy. And she's also the organizer behind the Workshop on Gender and Philosophy, WOGAP, which continues to thrive. And she's also worked to create PIKSI, P-I-K-S-I, which stands for the Philosophy in an Inclusive Key Summer Institute, which mentors undergraduates from underrepresented groups who wish to work in philosophy. We're really delighted to have such an accomplished and engaged philosopher with us this afternoon. Please join me in a warm Amherst welcome for Professor Haslinger.
Thank you for that lovely introduction. It's an honor to be here and to be part of the lecture series that has had so many wonderful people in it. My work for Doing Justice to the Social is sort of in, kind of almost in press. And so this is kind of a new project that I'm working on that is really inspired by my teaching, but it fits in with my general approach to critical theory. So here is an outline of what I'm going to do. I'm going to start with some very general questions. Then I'm going through a discussion of societies as complex systems, what that means. And we'll say a little bit about complexity and what that means, complex dynamic systems. And then I will try and break it down to talk about structures, practices, and social relations, because I think we can understand complexity or complex systems in this way by bringing these in when they're social systems. Then I'm going to talk about critique because the systems that we are part of are grotesquely unjust. And so what I'm interested in is how we can critique them and how we can engage with each other in social change. So in that process, I'm going to talk a bit about the path dependency of values, so that's situated values. You'll also see I'm talking about situated knowledge as we are coming to understand our values. And then I'll talk through a kind of methodology that I've been working with a colleague, Libby McDonald, to really address some very deep issues of global poverty and how that methodology works. And then I'll draw a conclusion. So here are the questions. What are structural and systemic, and why are such structural and systemic injustice so hard to combat? You know, there are millions of people who've been trying to combat it for a very long time, many of them incredibly dedicated, willing to, you know, sacrifice their lives for it, brilliant people. And it seems sometimes as if it's just getting worse, right? It's not obviously getting better. So We need some answer to this question. And I think that if we're going to really be effective in trying to bring about change, we have to have a better understanding of what we're up against. So that's why I'm interested in thinking about complex systems. I should also say that at heart, I'm a metaphysician. And so this is about social ontology and doing social ontology, because that's where my heart lies, except for activism. So I'm kind of a social ontologist and an activist, sort of a little bit of both. Okay, so this is, so you'll see, the first part is social ontology and the second part is activism, right? You get all of me here. Okay, never mind. So what critical interventions can make a difference, and what entitles us to intervene, and how do we do so in ways that are morally acceptable and effective, hopefully? Okay, so societies as complex systems. So there are three kinds of systems. Simple systems, that's kind of like your computer or your car, but you know, with computers in your car now, it's a little bit more complicated. Anyway, simple systems, mechanistic, things tend to be at the same level of size and shape, and they bump into each other, and you can talk about the mechanisms. Chaotic systems, they're really disorganized. You can't really do much with them to understand them a little bit, but not so much. And then there are complex systems, which are organized complexity that are kind of on the border of chaos, but they don't completely go chaotic. Complex systems are self-organizing, self-reproducing, or adaptive, and they're nonlinear or stochastic. And so they don't require a central authority to keep them going, and they don't always work in this simple mechanistic way. Okay, so there's a picture of a complex system. I think it's a protein. They didn't have a society like this, but anyway. So I think it's a protein. But that gives you an idea. They move, they change, they evolve, but it's not as if there's somebody in charge. So the behavior of individuals in the system is unpredictable, but their interactions give rise to stable, emergent features of the whole by virtue of an internal structure. Examples are ecosystems, economies, climate, brains, anthills, and societies. The structure of the system affects the individuals in it and the interactions that are possible. So in evolutionary systems, this is called niche construction. So what happens is the individuals come into an environment, and they change the environment so that they can survive there, and the environment changes them, so they become adapted to that environment. So there's a kind of structure, interaction with the individuals where they shape each other, and that happens in societies. So in such systems, local interactions can spontaneously self-organize without external intervention or central authorities. Okay, social systems and structures, on my view, are material. They're not simply composed of mental states or actions. Think of transportation systems, healthcare systems, judicial systems. So I emphasize this in part, come on in, welcome. So I emphasize this in part because a lot of social ontology in the analytic tradition is interested in the social as emerging through collective intentionality and joint intention. And for a lot of that literature, we don't even need bodies, right? You could have sociality and with just angels or something like that. But I don't think of sociality in that way. I think of the social system as a physical system. It's a system that involves desks and microphones and bodies and such like that. Social systems are also embedded in broader physical systems, their environment, that affect their functioning. The broader systems may oppose constraints, such as physical laws, or provide inputs, weather or climate. And one of the things to notice about systems like this is that the system is defined by a process of co-integration, where the elements of it are responsive to each other, and they are, you know, kind of like that niche idea, where the environment, it's typically only a one-way interaction between the things in the system and the things out of the system. I could talk about this forever if you want, because I just love it. Okay, so the environment of a system may include other systems, because systems do not entirely saturate a social space. Systems can overlap and intersect. Okay, so an example might be, let's go back, an example might be a school. So a school might be part of an education system. It might also be part of a healthcare system, because in this country, children get pitiful healthcare, and so the school nurse is an important front line for healthcare for children. The school is also part of a judicial system, because as we know, there are more and more police that are stationed in schools. So you can, and also, that's the place where people report as mandated reporters, parents who are supposed to have abused their children. And so there's the systems kind of overlap and interact with each other. Okay, so structures. I'm going to talk about structures now. Structures are not the same as systems, but I'll tell you in a minute about how they interact. So structures form the skeleton of the system. They consist of the nodes and relations. Remember, I was talking about individuals who stand in these structures, right? So we stand at the nodes, and these nodes, you know, in the relations change, and this is the skeleton of this, right? And so you've got the structure and the individuals in the structure. Social relations, which are these little bits, you know, the lines or edges, if you're into graph theory. Social relations are established, in my view, in practices. So X is a mother of Y is a biological relation, but it's also a legal and a social relation. So one is a mother of someone, not simply by virtue of giving birth to them, but by virtue of a set of laws and by virtue of a broad legal and social framework and a set of practices of caregiving and all of that sort of stuff. So that positions you, you know, as a mother in this complex web of social relations. Social relations are formed by participation in practices. I just tried to explain that. Okay, so what is a social practice? Coordination around resources. Now, I take resources to be things of positive or negative value. So we do organize ourselves around things of value like food and, you know, housing and things like that, but also we distribute toxic waste. So resource is a funny word for something if you're calling it a negative value, but in the literature that I'm part of, in the social theory literature, that's how they use the term resource, so I'm just fitting in with that. So coordination around resources is a fundamental human task, and our ability to develop flexible forms of coordination that can be passed down through social learning is the key to our evolutionary success. Not just our evolutionary success, but the evolutionary success of other animals. So the passed down through social learning, so wolves who hunt together, lions who hunt together, have to learn from each other how to manage it, given the, so to speak, personalities and the skills of the other animals in their pack. So social learning is something that's not specific to humans, but we are especially good at it. We teach our children what to eat, how to eat, who to mate with, blah, 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 blah. Okay, so coordination relies on meaning, symbols, default assumptions, and associations, what some might call culture, or what I call a cultural techne to shape our behavior. We not only learn what is edible, but develop cuisines, menus, dailies, and holiday rituals. So I use the term cultural techne because the term culture gets used in a bazillion different ways, has lots of associations with it. I want to use the term cultural techne because culture is a set of tools. It's not like American culture or Italian culture or whatever, this sort of broad hegemonic understanding. It is a set of tools that we use in order to coordinate with each other. So language, you know, words. Word is a part of a cultural techne that you use to communicate with each other. So are things like buildings with screens at the front and chairs set up like this, because none of you thought when you came in here that you would sit here for the whole talk, right? No one did. No one. You didn't have to deliberate about, oh, should I go sit right there or should I sit over there? Because you have been socialized in the techne of academic life since you were very little. And so this techne enables us to coordinate in the distribution of, let's hope, knowledge, right? And that's what universities do. And you start from the time you're like 4 years old and go to preschool. You learn the techne of school, the techne of learning, the techne of distribution of the resource of knowledge or whatever else it might be. Okay, here's a cedar waxwing. A cedar waxwing has a pre-installed capacity to eat little red round things. Holly berries are the favorite. If you throw beads on the floor, the cedar waxwing will, or the, you know, the ground, the cedar waxwing will try to eat it because it's not, it didn't learn what to eat from its, the mom and dad cedar waxwing. But we don't have that. We have to learn what berries are edible and what berries are not. We learn what is tasty. We develop tastes for things. So there are very, so in the notion of social learning, I mean, cedar waxwing, social, birds in general have to learn a lot. because, you know, they learn their songs and they learn how to respond to their environment, et cetera, et cetera. But they don't learn about what to eat. But we learn about what to eat. Okay, so this is culture. This is social learning, where this is not. Okay, so on my account, an ideology is a cultural technique gone wrong. It obscures or distorts what is valuable and or organizes us in unjust or harmful ways. So the tools of an ideology are going to organize you in ways that you, like, if you're a woman, you defer to men. And that's a cultural you develop that habitual responsiveness, or you stand further back, or you qualify what you say, etc. So you develop, you internalize a cultural techne that positions you in a way that is subordinate and reinforces the subordination. One example, but of course, that's just an easy example. There are lots of more complicated ones. Okay, so it's important when you see this, this is connecting culture with the material conditions that I was talking about in systems. Any human behavior is conditioned by multiple factors. Let's consider a meal. It's constrained by the physical demands of the human body, the geographical context and the edible things in it, the social, political, and legal context that makes certain edibles salient, available, and safe. So you have the Food and Drug Administration or whatever to figure out what can be sold. You have certain trade pacts so that we can get avocados in January, et cetera. And so that constrains or enables what we eat. Economic constraints on what you can afford, and the social meaning of the different foodstuffs. So there are some certain things that we eat for breakfast, certain things that you eat for dinner, certain things you eat on Thanksgiving, etc. Now, you don't have to eat turkey on Thanksgiving. I've been a vegetarian since 1970. But it's still the case that when I teach my food class, people say, oh, but if I were a vegetarian, what would I eat on Thanksgiving? I go, like anything other than meat, right? I don't know. What do you say? Anyway, so, but you also, this was something that came up when Clemson won the NCAA football championship, and he brought them to a celebratory banquet at the White House. He served them fast food. You might remember this, right? Everyone went, oh my God. Well, it wasn't. I mean, the reason why it was so outrageous is that he didn't seem to understand the social meaning of a banquet at the White House. It was also especially bad because he said to the effect, most of the Clemson football team is black. And he said, well, I knew they would like this, meaning they just only appreciate fast food. Really bad, but okay. Okay, so public meanings are internalized as we learn the languages of our local cultures. This is the basis for our fluency in social skills and our capacity for code switching. So we have different cultural techniques that we rely on at home and at work and in public spaces, etc. I share some cultural tools with philosophical colleagues across the globe, others with my neighbors, and still others with my dogs. This is not my dog, but we do communicate with dogs, and we have signals and their social meanings to, you know, hand gestures and such. Tools that are designed for one purpose are also used for other purposes, including critique. This is a term, bricolage in French, that Levi-Strauss used to talk about tools that, you know, a bricoleur in French is a handyman and uses whatever tools come to hand, right, or available. You use a screwdriver to open a paint can, such like that. This is a quote from William Sewell, who's a social historian who mostly works on the French Revolution, but has a tremendous amount of important work on social structure that has been very common in the social sciences. He says, users of culture will form a semiotic community in the sense that they will recognize the same set of oppositions, or what I call meanings, and therefore be capable of engaging in mutually meaningful symbolic action. To use the ubiquitous linguistic analogy, they'll be capable of using the grammar of the semiotic system, and I also think the lexicon and the grammar, to make understandable utterances. But just as when we speak a language, the fact that there's a lexicon and a grammar doesn't determine what we say. We can, you know, use that to say all kinds of things, but not everything, possibly. Likewise, the social meanings constrain and enable us as we try to communicate, by, you know, interacting with each other, right? I'm communicating here by what I'm wearing. For example, if I had worn a bathing suit instead or a tutu, that would have communicated something very different, right? Because I know the language of academic, professional sort of comportment and such, even though for many years it's been complicated because what do women philosophers wear? Ooh, that's really hard. Okay. Okay, so here we are. This is what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you some pictures. I really like visual aids and thinking. I'm going to give you some pictures and then I'll give it to you verbally. Always good to use multiple modalities. There we are trying to organize, trying to coordinate. So on my view, a practice consists of a set of social meanings that are public and the resources are the things in the world. And we could say, oh, do we interpret that as a pet or as food or as a pelt? How do we interpret it? And different communities will interpret it differently, right? They have different cultural techniques. So when we internalize these public meanings, they filter and shape what we perceive, what we notice, what we attend to. And that provides resources for forming attitudes. The attitudes guide our interaction with the resource, and then our interaction with it reinforces the social meanings. So, for example, pets, we around, you know, most people around where I am don't interpret bunnies as food or pelts, but they interpret them as pets, as at least possible pets, and so they breed them to be very fat and very slow so they can't get away from you, et cetera, et cetera. And so that's a kind of the niche, the reinforcement. Okay, this also happens with people. Is this a friend, a mother, or a sex object? Is this a friend, a janitor, or a criminal? Okay, so let's do it in words. Social practices are patterns of learned behavior. That's where that social learning component comes in, that at least in the primary instances enable us to coordinate as members of a group in creating, distributing, managing, maintaining, and eliminating a resource. Due to mutual responsiveness to each other's behavior and the resources as interpreted through these shared meanings. Okay, so I mentioned before, you know, we come in here, we know about academic lectures, we're coordinating without even having to think about it because we've internalized the social meanings of a podium, of chairs, of all of this. You know, you don't have to think, that is second nature to you. And so you just go and you sit down. And we don't have to negotiate it. We don't have to say, okay, people who aren't speaking, you go over there. And people who are speaking, go. No, that would take too much time. We can't possibly manage that. So we do it through internalizing the culture of the particular community and then just becoming fluent in it. And fluency just means you don't even have to deliberate. You just follow the rules. Well, they're not always rules, but oh well, I'm not going to talk about that. Okay, so in a structure, some nodes may allow only certain kinds of occupants, red, blue, green, think of genders, races, ages, because of what the relation requires. You could even think of it as the node of speaker and the node of audience, right? Those are different nodes that people can occupy differently, but it's sometimes the case that people are categorized so they can't occupy a certain node, right? This may be very implicit, but you know, there's going to be rules. So spouse, for a long time, spouses couldn't be the same sex, right? So you could have rules that said, okay, now if this is the spousal relation in our big system, it's got to have things of different colors, things of the different gender colors. It has a pink and a blue. Those are the only things that can stand in that relation to each other. Individuals abide by constraints because they enable coordination and make action intelligible. And of course, there are sanctions and punishments if you don't do it the right way. And the constraints imposed by social practices and relations affect the dynamics of the system. Individual agency, culture, and material conditions all affect how the system evolves. Okay, so what occupies these nodes, how those nodes are shaped by practices, and the material conditions that set the backdrop, right, in what I was talking about before. Okay, so where are the levers for social change? We want to change the system. The system is self-organizing. It adapts. you get perturbations and it goes, I got that, no problem. You know, think about ecosystems, right? They adapt to changes. They adapt to climate change to some extent and then they collapse. But before they collapse, there's some adaptation that happens. And the same is true of social system. It's amazing. Like, think about the position of women over the last, 100 years. Huge, huge changes. But the system has adapted to that in complicated sorts of ways. So where are the levers? Does changing minds, that is correcting explicit or implicit bias, change the system? Well, I think that's possible, but notice if we're coordinating with each other based on our fluent participation and practices, your mind may change, but your agency is not going to change that much because you still need to coordinate with people, right? And you're going to get punished if you don't coordinate the right way. So this can be helpful, but I'm not a thoroughgoing fan about that. So we could change instead the semiotic and or material conditions in this. Because again, this is what's creating the relations which form the structure, right, to make the whole thing go. So I've talked in other contexts about changing the semiotic conditions through conceptual engineering. I'm not gonna talk about that today. But this could change the structures and entrenched systems formed by the practices. If we could change either the material conditions or the social meanings. And, we want to change the people too, but we have to change all three, really. And so I was suggesting starting with this. You may get some effects, but I think you need to work more on these two. Philosophers don't tend to like that, but oh well, because they like to just change minds. Okay, so if we're going to be involved in changing the system, what are some of the challenges? If our social practices and practical orientations are shaped by ideology, which I'm assuming for our purposes they are, notice ideology is not a set of explicit beliefs that ally you with a political party. In my sense of ideology, that's not what an ideology is. An ideology is the cultural techne that gets you to fluently participate in injustice. And we're all fluently participating in injustice all the time. All the time, right? White supremacy, patriarchy, global capitalism, we're doing it all the time. And we do it unthinkingly and without having to deliberate about it, because oftentimes it's the only thing we can do. One of the examples, and I'm going to take too long, I'm sure. No, I'm all right. So I used to have a co-op, Central Square Co-op. Everybody from Cambridge knows it. Co-op. I could buy, great food, local produce. I could buy it and, direct from farms, whatever. Well, the co-op closed because it couldn't sustain itself. And basically now the main place to get basics is Target. And, I could go to the co-op in Jamaica Plain, which is kind of a ways, right? Takes a long time. I could take the T there, but the T doesn't go directly there. The T is our subway. So I end up going to Target, right? That's material conditions. That's saying I am participating in a practice, not because I think it's the best thing to do, go to Target to buy food, but because the material conditions are structured so that is probably the best of many bad choices. Okay, so if you want to critique the system, the culture, or the material conditions, there are two ways to do it. This is the traditional critical theory dilemma. I don't think it's a good, well-thought dilemma, but you can kind of see where it comes from. One way is through external critique. And if you rely on beliefs and values that aren't broadly accepted in the social context, our critique will be at best ineffective and at worst paternalistic. So international development in the United States has been incredibly paternalistic. It has relied on external critique of indigenous and other southern cultures in the global South, and it has been extremely problematic, and it's been external critique. So one thing we want to kind of avoid is external critique, I think. Internal critique, well, if you rely on the beliefs and values that are internal to a culture which is ideologically shaped, critique is going to be unlikely to identify the wrongs appropriately, because what you're doing is using the culture, Now, there is a way to deal with this, and a lot of the people who are working in the critical theory tradition now talk about immanent critique, and I think immanent critique is a good way to proceed, but I'm not going to tell you about all the different ways that immanent critique is understood. Instead, I'm going to try and capture what could be called a form of immanent critique, which is neither of these. So there are two challenges I'm going to talk about today. One is, are there the normative challenge, are there objective moral truths by reference to which we can judge social arrangements to be unjust? And from what standpoint does the critic speak? Which insights of which agents are warranted? So are we going to be outside? Are we going to be inside? Who is the critic here? And what norms or values are they relying on when they do the critique? And my response, just in summary, and I'll recap this again, one way to handle this problem is to rely on situated knowers who gain a critical standpoint by engaging collectively in alternative practices that produce new forms of value. So situated knowledge and situated values. That's what we're going to aim for. Okay. So let's spend a second talking about social critique, because social critique is not about criticizing an individual, and it's not about criticizing the political structure. Now, philosophers have a tendency to see the normative questions as falling either into the ethical question, what should I do? You know, what am I morally responsible for? And the other is, how should we organize ourselves in a polity, where that polity is like the government, right? With, and maybe the economy as well. How should we do that? How should we? And so the government, I think, or the state, is sometimes considered as a great big individual, right? A great big individual that's organized in a certain way and tries to control us. But as I mentioned, complex dynamic systems, the state does not control us, right? And our individual agency does not, you know, determine how the system is. There's this whole level of the social domain that gets left out, and we need to think about how we want to organize ourselves in terms of like cuisine, right? The state isn't going to say, I'm sorry, you never can eat meat again, right? I mean, they could try, but it's not going to work, right? Because we have cuisines and histories and traditions, this is the social domain that we're talking about, right? And it's not going to be the case that you can just decide all by yourself. I have a friend from Iceland, and she said, you know, it would have been great to be vegetarian in Iceland, but, you know, in Iceland, there's not a real great, you know, season. We're talking about the ancient Icelanders. You know, there's not a long growing season. So if we didn't eat fish, we would have died, right? So there's the material conditions that are determining here, too. Okay, so we've got to think about social critique as slightly different from either political critique or ethical, you know, evaluation. So as I see the critical project, we're not starting the normative inquiry from scratch. Those engaged in justified political resistance cannot avoid the claim that there are some moral truths. So the task is not to argue for an objective basis for moral judgment in general. Now, I actually think that, I don't want to go into this now, but we could talk about that because I'll take too long. Okay, so basically I'm not doing meta-ethics and saying, what is the foundation of moral objectivity, right? We're assuming there's some objective moral truths. In critique or in the social critique, the site of ideology critique is the social domain. It includes both individuals and the state, but the focus is what practices should we engage in, what social norms should we embrace, and how should we go on from here together. It's anti-utopian and highly contextual. A critical social theory provides tools to identify ways in which our current practices are inadequate, so we can do better. And what counts as better is a contextual matter. There's no one-size-fits-all solutions. What's better will depend hugely on local factors, such as the geography, the economy, cultural traditions, history, human biology. So I work with some friends, colleagues in philosophy in Germany, and we talk about race. And we talk about, well, okay, so we need to think about how to deal with white supremacy. White supremacy in Germany is really different from white supremacy in the United States. there isn't a one-size-fits-all solution to the problem of white supremacy, because it takes very historically different forms in different contexts. So again, we're talking about this question of what social norms we should embrace and how we should go on from here together. You can't say, okay, globally, we're going on like this together. You go, sorry, it doesn't work like that. And because in existing societies, injustice is already rampant, rectification is a priority, and resistance is the starting point. Okay, so this is to, you know, taking into account all this contextuality and such like that, you might be concerned that once we recognize there are many acceptable ways to organize social life and that critique is always situated, we just have to give up on the objectivity of value, right? Because it's all just, you know, you got these values over here and you got these values over here, and there's nothing that you can say about what's truly valuable. But objective values, I think, need not be ahistorical or acontextual. They may be path dependent. What's valuable depends, inter alia, on what is available to value. So I'm going to talk about it first in connection with an example I think is a bit easier to get, and then in the next slide I'll talk about the moral path dependency. Okay, this is drawn in this section on path dependency. I'm drawing on Jack Balkin's cultural software. Jack Balkin is a law professor at Yale who works on ideology, among other things. He says, values are not so much what humans have as what they do and feel. Human beings possess an inexhaustible drive to evaluate, to pronounce what is good and bad, beautiful and ugly, advantageous and disadvantageous. But without culture, human values are inchoate and indeterminate. Through culture, they become differentiated, articulated, and refined. Consider the example of music. This is still Balkin. Before culture, there are no electric guitars, violins, or orchestra. There's no art of orchestration, no sonata allegro form, no idea of jazz or the blues. There's only the human delight in producing and listening to interesting and beautiful sounds. And throughout human history, people develop different ways of making and organizing sounds, which they test against their developing sense of beauty and interest. The sense of the beautiful and the interesting, in turn, is developed through exposure to and use of the cultural tools available to them within their culture. So go back to that idea that there's, you know, your material conditions, which might be what instruments are available. There's your the kind of personal interest in rhythm and melody and such like that, some of which may be innate. There's, or at least, well, I could come back to that. And then there's the culture, which positions you so that you can use or create tools to form communities that make music that you find beautiful. And in doing so, you may change the kinds of instruments that you have available, because you make instruments, they're technology. And so there's a kind of interdependence again between the material, the cultural, and the individual. And what he's suggesting here is that it is in this that value is produced in a concrete way. There may be an inchoate notion of beauty or rhythm or music or like what's danceable to, but it's only in this process of enculturation that there's anything that is, you know, could be counted as a concrete value. Okay. So it's one thing to grant the path dependency of aesthetic value. Bad music isn't a moral failure, but is moral value also path dependent? And here's Balkin's argument. He says, we concretize our indeterminate value of justice by creating human institutions and practices that attempt to enforce it and exemplify it, and even and especially if we recognize that all of these institutions are imperfectly just. Of course, because justice is an indeterminate standard, there is no necessary way to exemplify it. Human beings can also generate ever new examples of injustice and oppression in different times and places. They find new ways to work evils on their fellow creatures and to create monuments to brutality and repulsiveness. But here, in response to this, which I think is in keeping with the Balkin idea, I'm going to draw on Horkheimer, and I do that because Horkheimer is one of the early Frankfurt School critical theorists, and so but many contemporary critical theorists have cast Horkheimer aside, but not me. And he says, if the concepts employed in critique, which sprang from social movements today, seem empty because no one stands behind them, yet the truth of them will out, for the thrust toward a rational society, which admittedly seems to exist today only in the realms of fantasy, is really innate in every man. Now, I think we could quibble about innateness, but what I think he's trying to argue here is that there is a very deep resistance to being brutalized, to being objectified, and that is, if not innate, it's very primitive. And notice we do find it in other social animals, right? Other social animals will care a lot about a member of their pack who's injured because they coordinate with the member of that pack, right? They care about that. And they also care about if someone in the pack takes all the food after it was a group hunt, right? These are very, very basic indeterminate responses that we have to our possibilities of living together. And so what I think is going on both in Horkheimer, I mean, Jane Mansbridge, Iris Young, Balkin, is they're saying there is this indeterminate resistance to certain forms of coordination. Sometimes that is tamped down because we are punished if we express it. But in cases that are, you know, a little bit better, what we do is we seek to manifest that, make it more concrete, make it to realize it in certain ways, but then we get it really wrong, and then you go, whoa, shit, this is really bad. We've gone down the wrong path. We've got to start over. Okay, so place your bets. I think critique rests on a bet that as long as our deep but indeterminate sense of justice is not destroyed, which it can be by all kinds of things, we can build resistance and create better and more just social formations. But the values are going to be created and the knowledge is going to be created about what they are. Okay, so is there a way to intervene in social practices to change social relations that make up the social structure that sustain the system? So here's the social practice. Can we intervene here to change the social relations that make up the structure that sustains the system? That's what we're looking for, right? Because at least this is the ontology that I've been trying to draw. So we want to intervene here to change this, to change this, to change that. Okay, lessons so far. The levers for social change can be found in the different components of practices, material resources, cultural techne, and individual agency. And change in practices can build on and create new knowledge and new forms of value. So, you know, new ways of acting, let's look at. Technology can provide new know-how, how to drive, new things of value, fancy cars, trustworthy service in every neighborhood, and new forms of agency. You know, we get to travel. I mean, there's this wonderful book by SEO, I forgot her first name, I think it is, about policing starting in the policing system that we have are currently starting with the development of the car. Anyway, technology, policing, really interesting. Okay, I can give you that reference later. So new meanings and norms, which are a change in a cultural technique, can highlight aspects of social life that were otherwise occluded and distorted. So you might find, you know, it highlighting the fact that women aren't allowed in the public space is they aren't allowed to drive a car, they're not given driver's licenses or something like that. So there can be ways in which these changes in technology and the material conditions can highlight new things that you didn't notice before. Birth control pill did that for women, being able to control pregnancy without letting the man know, control fertility without letting the man know, because you take the pill by yourself. You don't have to tell anybody. You don't have to stop intercourse in order to insert it, et cetera, right? It was really important, really important. Okay, and agents who take up new practices form new relationships and can thus change the structure of the system and generate new possibilities for agency. Road trips, yes. Okay, so I'm gonna talk now about community-based problem solving and a way to think about how to do this in the context of global poverty, though I think it can be used in other contexts. I'm only going to be able to speak directly and concretely about it in the context of international development. So social movements come in many forms, not all of which are justified, effective, or meaningful to those who suffer most. Movements built from local engagement and community-based organizations can be especially effective, however, and also morally sound. Small efforts can evolve by creating networks between local participants, organizations, and eventually policymakers and legislatures, but organizing need not start big to be effective, especially if you're bottom-up. So I'm going to sketch a methodology based on work at MIT's D-Lab, which D can stand for many things. I was just at the 20th anniversary, and they said it was design, development, and duct tape. Anyway, but you get the idea. But the success of any model is going to depend on the issues being addressed because everything is contextual. Okay, so here's MIT D-Lab. The mission is it works with people around the world to develop and advance collaborative approaches and practical solutions to global poverty challenges. This I'm not going to read through at all, but it says participatory design is not a silver bullet, and there are times when it can be more costly, more time-consuming, and you have more of an urgency, but we have to try, when possible, to use this. So I'm going to tell you what this is. And Amy Smith, who's the founder of D-Lab, has this line that says, impact is not just the product of innovation, it is the process of innovation, and what you do in D-Lab is teach people how to design for themselves. Okay, so here's the core strategy. If you give someone a fish, they eat for a day if their culture allows them to eat the fish you offer. Don't give me a fish, I'm not gonna eat for a day, right? Because I believe that would be wrong. If you teach someone to fish, they can feed themselves until the water is contaminated or the shoreline is seized for development, right? If you teach someone to think critically and be politically conscious, then whatever the challenge, they can organize with their peers and stand up for their interests. But if you also engage them in the design process, they become agents of change in relationships, social norms, and material conditions. This is where D-Lab lives. It says, yeah, all that stuff is good. But this is where we have to do really substantial, where we can and we should do substantial intervention. Okay, here's the design cycle very, very quickly. This is what we teach when we go into communities. You gather information, frame the challenge, think of ideas, choose the best idea, work out the details, build it, test it, get feedback, gather more information, frame the new challenge, et cetera. And you go around and around and around in this design cycle. Okay, so there are these different ways of doing this. People will often in the development domain talk about user-centered design, which is, well, you consult the stakeholders and then you design for them. That works. It's sometimes very good, like medical devices. Sometimes you devise a medical device that is very hard to do in the global South, in communities that are in desperate poverty. Another is design with users. This is co-design, where you put stakeholders part of the design team, you teach them how to design. And then ultimately, you want design by users, so the stakeholders are the designers as well. So let's go step by step in the interventions. Remember, one of the first steps that you have to do in the design cycle is gather information and frame the problem. Well, we do it through public narrative. Public narrative starts with the story of self, then moves to a story of us, and then to a story of now. This is work by Marshall Ganz. He's at the Kennedy School at Harvard. A story of self communicates who I am, my values, my experience, and what I do. A story of us communicates who we are, our shared values, our shared experience, and why we do what we do. And a story of now transforms the present to a moment of challenge, hope, and choice. So I'll give you a little context for this. So I work in an area in Kenya with an organization there called the Society Empowerment Project, and that suffers from many, many, many problems. There's, you know, food insecurity, water insecurity, high HIV/AIDS rate. So women are 27% of women have HIV in that community, 24% of men do. Many, many orphans because of the death due to HIV. There's very little education, high teenage pregnancy. So more than a quarter of girls have their first live birth by 18, and 15% have it before 15. So right, very serious problem. 5% of the community have running water, 3% have electricity. Okay, so what we did in a program, we did this, isn't it? But we did in a program in the spring, is you get young women in high school together, and you say, tell us about your first period. What happened in your first period? Also, sex ed, through the church, abstinence, nothing, no information. So they start to tell their story. But they blame themselves, right? They say, I can't do this. You know, I bleed all over the place, et cetera, et cetera. I can't go to school because it's just so embarrassing. Menstrual shame is ubiquitous all over the world, just saying. So they blame themselves, they're shamed, they're whatever. And then, but you get them all to share it, and they go, wait, you had that experience too? Really? All of us had that experience? Whoa, maybe the problem isn't just us. Maybe there's a background practice, set of structures, or whatever that is a problem. So this, our shared values, shared experience, and then a story of now, we give them the design tool, and we say, okay, design a solution. Figure out what you're going to do to prevent this from happening. Okay, so these are different projects. This is the menstrual project in Kenya, but this is teaching them design. You give them two pieces of paper, and then you get them to the challenge is who can build the highest tower of bananas using only two pieces of paper. No tape, nothing else. This is to get them to the point where they say, oh, things that are just hanging around can be used for different purposes, right? There's a creativity that's emerged there. So creative capacity building workshops are, okay, I'm gonna have to go fast, are 10-day co-creation workshops amongst people who stay together in the same village, school, or organization, face the same livelihood challenges. They're taught the co-creative design and business thinking processes, supported with materials to create prototypes, and then see how they can address it. Ideally, what happens is that the resources they draw on are resources that are available in the local community and not imported from MIT. Trainings may include developing capacities for intervention into the political process. So my colleague Libby, who's right here as Libby, she and I teach the course together. She works with gold miners in Colombia, moving from informal sector work to formal sector work. I've got to keep going. Build it. So you build things. This is a charcoal press. You teach them how to use tools to form metal plungers and such like this. They also use it to create banners. So here's an example of work that's done on a movement for land rights for women in Malawi. And what they do is they print out these sheets that they then can take from door to door to door to explain why land rights for women are valuable. So it's not always like a charcoal press. Resource access, we create opportunities to build resource centers that can be supplied with tools and such, training and computing, et cetera. This is a MIC coding and life skills and laboratories online training for women. Dissemination, so people come together who are building charcoal presses in different parts of the world so they can share their stories about what worked and what didn't work. We're having a conference at MIT on November 6th, 7th, and 8th where we're bringing people working on sexual and reproductive health from Peru, Colombia, Bolivia, Brazil, and Kenya. So that'll be kind of great. And here is the project. These are menstrual pads that are given to girls once every year or so. As you know, menstrual pads, you need them more than once a year. You know, they're pretty excited when they get it. But now we've got them designing menstrual pads and making menstrual pads and wet bags so that they can carry them. Okay, key features of co-design when it works. It draws on situated knowledge of the local challenges, culture, and resources. It draws on local norms and values without being dogmatic. It awakens the desiring negation, this sense of things could be better, it doesn't have to be this way, I'm not going to be ashamed of my body. It prompts creative paradigm shifts. These, I think, are central to ideology critique, and that's something I discussed in a paper, 2019 maybe, I don't know. It provides transposable skills that can be used to address multiple challenges, and this is an increase in agency. It builds self-confidence and buy-in. It builds community, and which is, of course, key to movement building. It changes relationships and social roles, because if women suddenly, you know, can use a table saw or something like that, that changes their relationship to others in their community, because they have a skill now that others maybe want to work with them to, you know, produce something with that skill. It changes the material conditions because there's a new technology or something more like a labor formalization, which isn't technology exactly, but it's an important consequence. It allows for entrepreneurship but doesn't require it, and it can be locally sustainable. Okay, so here's the conclusion. What are the questions that we asked? Why are structural and systemic injustice so hard to combat? Because they're embedded in complex systems that are self-organizing and self-sustaining. What critical interventions can make a difference? Changes in agency, culture, and material conditions that make up the practices that structure the system. And what entitles us to intervene? Because, you know, that's a moral question. And the history has been really bad on this issue. Co-design with situated knowers who gain a critical standpoint by collectively creating alternative practices that produce new forms of value that are, to the best of our knowledge, determinations of our indeterminate sense of justice. Thank you.